Gang, are you looking for better sleep and relaxation or relief from pain or anxiety without feeling totally drugged? Well, let me tell you about True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. True Hemp Science promises premium quality, pure ingredients, and true value. They source the highest grade organic hemp from around the world to handcraft the finest full spectrum CBD products in the Austin area and beyond. They offer a complete line of full spectrum CBD products, including oils, tinctures, skincare lotions, sports rubs, gummies, and chocolates. Gang, I have been using their products for the last few months, and they've lowered my anxiety, and they've given me incredibly restful sleep. The kind of sleep that when you wake up, you feel rested and ready to take on the day, as opposed to waking up feeling anxious or waking up feeling groggy. Well, gang, I have good news, too. How Did I Get Here has teamed up with True Hemp Science to bring you a special offer that benefits all of us. Spend $65 or more at TrueHempScience.com and receive 296 milligrams of their number 81 distillate, which is great for sleep or relaxation, for free. That's right, gang, for free. Just go to TrueHempScience.com/HDIGH. That's TrueHempScience.com/HDIGH. Balance your body and mind with True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. Let's get down.
You may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time. How did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Maldi.
When we talked.
All right. Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys all had a good weekend, whatever it is you did this weekend. As you know, like 2 weeks ago, I tested positive for COVID and I was sick and it wiped me out for a few days and I started feeling better last week, but then I felt like I wasn't like fighting the illness anymore. And so I'd feel better when I wake up in the morning. But as the day would go on, I would become so fatigued that by like 3-4 o'clock, I'd have to like lay down, you know, I started nodding off on days and stuff. It was real weird, real weird. Anyway, I ended up testing myself on Thursday because I thought I was sick again and might have relapsed. So every night I was feeling tired. And so finally Sunday, I had a meeting in the morning for this television show I'm doing. I'll tell you guys about it. It's pretty cool. It's a local show, local like songwriter show. I can't remember the exact name of it off the top of my tongue, but I'm shooting it next week. It won't air for a while, like whatever, in the fall. Anyway, I went to a pre-production meeting for that, like a pre-interview thing for that. And I went and sat down with the producer and director guy. And then I was like, hey man, I'm going to go while it's still daytime before I lose all my energy, I'm going to, you know, go grab a, you know, lunch and maybe a cocktail with a friend, who knows, right? So I grab Rosie, we go and on our way to meet our friend at this place, I walk in and bam, don't you know it, man, my ex-girlfriend is sitting there. The dog goes nuts. That's her mom. She went nuts. So happy to see her. Then it's like this awkward introduction to whatever she was eating lunch or having a drink with some dude. And oh man, it all came rushing back. If you could listen to the show a few weeks ago, I went on the Instagram to try and sort of like have some connection, because to tell her that I'm still not over it, I'm in love with her, I don't know how not to be. And when I went on Instagram, I looked at her stories and she was in a different city with a dude and kissing him on the cheek, like a romantic thing. So I left the place. Okay, so I see her. It's not really like hi or anything. She introduced me to her friend, and my friend was sitting there, and I just like sat down, and I was like, hey man, that's my ex-girlfriend. She's at the table like right next to us. Can we get the fuck out of here? My dog's going nuts. And she's like, yeah, let's go. Cool, totally cool person. So we cruise to another place. And obviously, when I get to that place, honestly, I was shaken to the point where I was shaking, like I was trembling, and my heart was just pounding. So I had a vodka and soda, had another vodka and soda, went home, had some vodka and sodas here, talked on the phone, called some people I know, like, ah, man, you're never gonna believe what happened. This happened. And then somehow in my mind, I was like, I'm gonna win her back tonight. This is it. After about 5 drinks. Meanwhile, gang, when I went to go eat lunch with my friend, I was so upset by running into the girlfriend or ex-girlfriend that I was like, I couldn't eat. So at this, I didn't eat at all. And so I'm like drinking 5-6 vodka sodas. And then I'm like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the place next to where she lives with Rosie. We used to go there all the time, hang out, text her, be like, hey, I'm here. Come down here and talk. And I told her in a text earlier that I was still in love with her. Oh God, why did I do that? It's so embarrassing. Why am I telling you guys? Because it's true. We've all been fucking through this, right? And I need to talk about it. I need to talk about it in a place where I feel safe. And here, I feel safe with you guys. You know, I know it sounds weird because it's going out there, but you're getting the rest of the story too. Because if you listen to how upset I was just from seeing her on Instagram, imagine running into her in person. So I text her. I'm like, hey, I'm at the place with the dog, the place we used to go and hang out all the time. Our default hang. And hanging out there, she texts back. She says, hey, man, I'm dating someone. Sorry you're in this world of shit you live in. Bye. So talking to my old roadie, Jake, my friend, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm at the place where we used to go. And I invited her down, and she said, no dice, got a guy. So me and Jake went drinking. And Rosie, we took Rosie with us. It's pretty fun. Anyway, Uber Pets. I took an Uber Pet, just so you know. I didn't just jump in my car after 6 vodka sodas. There's Uber Pets. Costs a little more, but you can take your dog in an Uber. So anyway, that's what happened that night. Terribly disappointing. Woke up yesterday feeling humiliated, you know, realized that probably outside of even just like how sick I've been, I probably shouldn't be drinking. Probably right now in the mental health state that I'm in, I probably shouldn't be drinking. And I probably need to sort of like sit down and focus on how to pull myself out of this mindset I've been in. So I'm going to live my life, go out there to places where maybe I can meet people, but also take this time to sort of work on myself so that emotionally I'm prepared. When the opportunity does come a knocking, I'll be in a good enough place to be like, all right, you know, because realizing seeing what happened to me over the last couple of weeks from seeing her on Instagram and running into her in person, I'm not in any kind, like, I didn't realize like how much of my myself I had given to this person or to the idea of this person. Really, at this point, it's the idea of this. I haven't seen her since February. So, yeah, it's the idea of the person. So, man, onward and upwards, I guess, right? That's what I'm going to do. Take this time, work on myself, maybe not drink and do fun stuff. Hang out with Rosie. We're back in our exercise groove. We're doing the 5 miles every morning, going to the dog park, doing the thing. Gang, I have a great show for you today. Singer, songwriter, guitar player, Bruce Smith is my guest. His brand new album, 1,000 Horses, came out back in July. Fantastic record, co-produced by Bruce Smith himself and Randy Caballero, or Randy Caballero, however you want to say it. Also produced by my dear old friend, the great Omar Vallejo, or Vallejo, however you want to pronounce it. This record's really, really great, man. He explores a lot of like territory and brings back this rockabilly vibe. He actually won the Buddy Holly Scholarship Award in 2019. We have a great, great conversation. Great conversation about his journey in music, being born in Detroit, and how, yeah, those of you that listen to the show, you know that I'm fascinated with people that come from Detroit. I believe there's a work ethic you're born with, a certain toughness you're born with, and a certain attitude that comes out of Detroit. And I think that Bruce Smith has it, even though he's a really nice guy. It's not like he's really mean or anything. Anyway, we also have this talk about this really interesting part of his life where he graduated from college with a political science degree and went to work in the House and Senate mailrooms and was a congressional intern and staffer, and he worked on a gubernatorial campaign. So there's this whole like working on being a staffer for a campaign and stuff that was really interesting and fascinating. And for me, because that's been my dream job, that if I wasn't a musician or artist or something like that, I would want to be some kind of political consultant or some kind of thing on a campaign. It seems like it would be exciting. Exciting. Anyway, great conversation with Bruce Smith. Such a talent, man. This record's fantastic. I want to thank my friend Joe Ray for setting us up. You can find Bruce Smith at brucesmithband.com. Okay? Get out there and check him out, man. 1,000 Horses is the record. Bruce Smith is the guy. And this is me and Bruce chatting it up right now. Let's get down.
trap, blue jab, blue name, blue scrap, blue dab, blue bat, blue see my precious, blue Lana Ross. I got to tell you no, sir. No, I'm not the most. No, I'm getting closer when I see the ass ghost. Rambling for Campbellton now. Down in Corpus Christi on the Corn Box Road, Daddy D. Spencer leaning on the radio.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say sorry about the thing. I got the Rona last week.
And I'm so sorry for you. Are you feeling okay?
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot better today. I mean, I've got, you know, scratchy throat and a little stopped up still. And I'm kind of tired, but otherwise I'm good, man.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're doing all right. I felt terrible hearing about that.
Yeah, man, I feel like now it's going around, like it's rampant.
Oh, it's crazy. It's scary. My wife's a flight attendant, so she's especially nervous about this current outbreak.
Oh yeah, no shit, man. Because they took off the masks.
It's insane. Yeah.
A flight attendant, huh? That's kind of like a fantasy of like a young. It's like going back to your like teenage, like you know preteen kind of thing.
Right. Right. So she's all my dreams come true.
So, dude, that means that you get to travel a lot.
I should, but I don't. We don't take near advantage of enough because I'm always playing and stuff. So it's we've really been delinquent on that. We gotta get back on the stick, you know, because it's something we haven't taken near enough advantage of.
No, yeah, it's too bad, man.
Yeah.
So hey, let me ask you a question. You played a thing like last weekend, a Buddy Holly thing.
Yes.
Is that the thing? My friend Gabe Rhodes is playing that this week.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's up there this week for the songwriters retreat. I was at the songwriters retreat a couple years back. That's where I met Gabe. He's an awesome guy, man.
Awesome guy, right?
Awesome guy, awesome player. Just and his mom is the greatest.
Yeah.
In the whole wide world. Great family.
Yeah, that's. I met him through his mom. I did. I played on a record of hers, and she did a couple songs of mine.
Oh yeah, she's so awesome. That's so cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So there was a photo on your Instagram where you're carrying an amp and it says it's
yes,
Buddy
sir.
Holly's amp. Were you playing through that amp?
Oh no, I was just carrying it. Yeah, that was, we were taking stuff from the Buddy Holly Center over to the Buddy Holly Hall where the performance was. And I got to transport it. So it was like an out of body experience, man. I started tearing up.
I bet, man.
Yeah, it was really something. So, yeah, it's a beautiful old Gibson amp, and just you saw the tubes on it. So cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So you do play, you did a record release. This record, A Thousand Horses, is really good, man.
Thank you so much. That means a lot coming from you, buddy.
Yeah. Really? I'm just joking. I'm sorry. I've got
COVID.
No,
I mean, really.
Whenever
yes,
someone says that, then all of a sudden you think when someone says that, you're like, oh, shit, did I say the right thing?
No,
it's really good. Yeah. I love that there's like it opens up that Campbellton song is so like Eddie Cochran vibe. I love it.
That's what I was going for. And in fact, you'll get a kick out of this. There was people at the Buddy Holly birthday party this weekend that were they're doing a documentary on Eddie Cochran. And I told him, I said, man, more often than not, we in the summertime, we open our sets with summertime blues, and it was not summertime. It's Come On Everybody. And I actually told him that I had Campbellton on this record that was an ode to Eddie and Gene Vincent for sure.
That's awesome. So did you grow up listening to that stuff, man?
I grew up listening to everything. My dad, we had all the Beatles records. We had all the Frank Sinatra records, you know, the Doors, Stones. He had everything when it first came out. My mother's a musician, a great musician. She had, you know, classical music on the radio, but I love that rockabilly stuff. I love that Eddie Cochran stuff. You know, it's just gets in your bones.
It really does, man. And it's funny because I wonder if you got that stuff. Cause like I came to a lot of those, like I had young parents and like aunts around. Everybody was huge Beatles fans and stuff like that. But I learned about almost all of the people from those early Beatles records. You know what I mean? Like you get Carl Perkins, you get like, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of retrofit that stuff. Like people came to the Blues through the Stones and stuff.
Oh yeah, no, they. It's so funny. We had this conversation a couple times this weekend. How the Beatles brought all that American music back to us. The Beatles and the Stones. You know, it's so cool.
Oh, totally. Totally. That's really interesting how that happens, isn't it? But you're like, let's talk a little bit about the record, because I want to ask you a couple things real quick, and we'll talk about the record a bit, and then we'll get into your life. It's weird. Weird not being able to look at you, though. I'm looking at my kitchen.
Well, you sound good, brother.
Thanks. Thanks, man. Who is Spencer Jarman, and why do I know his name?
Spencer Jarman has been around for a long, long time. He's out of Corpus Christi, but he's been in Austin forever. He's played with Connie Bone. He's played with Calvin Russell, Paula Nelson. He played with, why can't I think of her name? I'll think of it in a second. You'll know who I'm talking about. But he's been ubiquitous, and he's a great, great, great guitar player. He was in a band called the Vanguards. A long time ago.
Thank you. That's how I know who
there
he
you
is.
Go.
Okay.
Yeah. And I should have known, you would have known that. But Jane Bond was who I was trying to
remember. Oh, yeah.
He played with Jane a while back. So.
But
yeah, the Vanguards was his band with his brother that was like a great, great, great band.
Yeah, man. And I want to say that's the band I saw. Were they based in L.A. for a while?
I think they were.
Because I saw them at like a weird... They were on tour, and they played a weird, like, suburb restaurant gig that had music. And I saw their name and that they were playing at this weird fucking place, and I went. And I saw them. And I can't remember if I talked to them or not. I was young. I was like 20 or something.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I'm pretty sure it was them, because I remember kind of like I had a rockabilly thing growing up, you know, like a bit of one, not full on, but.
Right. Yeah, no, they were fun, and that might have been on that same stretch where I think they went up to San Francisco, one of the little towns up there, Sausalito or somewhere, and I think, or the place, there's a, what's the name of the little town? Anyway, but I think Clarence Clemens sat in with them once or twice, so that was kind of cool when they were up in California.
That's pretty awesome, man. Okay, so you had Spencer, and Zeke is his brother?
Zeke is his son. Tremendous guitar player in his own right. He has a band called Batty Jr. that plays around town. They're great. His girlfriend, Sadie Wolf, is the cellist, and they got a great group. We just saw them last week at the South Austin Beer Garden. He's playing bass for us, and he just gets the groove, and he's just a great, great player, great kid, you know, just like his pop.
Yeah. And so Randy Caballero is the guy that you did you co-produced the record with, an easier keyboard player.
That is correct. Yeah. Randy works with Omar over at 512 Studios. He actually won a Grammy producing Ruben Ramos a few years back.
Wow.
So he's been with us for a long, long time. He's like a brother. It's kind of a family band. You know, you have Zeke and Spencer, father and son. Connor Church is my nephew, the drummer, and then Randy's our primo. He's our cousin. So
that's awesome. So did you guys record it at 512?
We sure did. Omar kind of oversaw everything. Randy produced it, and then Omar came in and did his magic. And he would always check in and just did a tremendous job. And it's a great studio. And Rich Bauer did a lot of the engineering and. Just love doing work with those guys. We've been doing it for a while, and it was a pleasure.
Yeah, you had some great guests on there: Matt Hubbard, Jeff Botta, Hayden Viterra.
Oh yeah, great, 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 great players. Yeah, Hayden's just ridiculous. I mean, he came in and killed it. And then Matt, we've been playing with Matt forever, and he's a part of the family as well. And he killed a couple tracks. You know, we got that rockabilly thing on Campbellton that he just jumped all over. And then Jeff Botta, he did background vocals for us. Yeah. He said, let me just try a couple things. You know, I sent him some tracks, and I swear to God, in 10 minutes later, he had like six or seven different things for like eight songs. I was like, you're ridiculous. So, and it was all great. So
that's amazing, man. So what record is this for you?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's five or six. We did a couple EPs. This is the fourth full play. So it's been a little while since we released the last one. We've been kind of itchy, you know. COVID kind of set us back. So yeah. So I think it's five or six. So I should know that.
What did you do, Bruce, during COVID? What was your how did you navigate that?
I'm gonna tell you something, Johnny. Here's what happened. We've been playing at the Driscoll Hotel every Wednesday for about, well, back then it was for like since 2008. So the deal came down the week before. It would have been March the 11th, and they said that's it for the Driscoll for a while. We're shutting it down. So that, you know, the Monday, Tuesday came around, and I'd seen a couple people had done some live streams. I think it was Chris Martin and I think John Legend were going to do some live streams. I was thinking, well, what the hell? You know, we've had somebody put us on Facebook before. Let's just try it on Wednesday night because we've been playing on Wednesday nights forever. So I had two of the guys come over, and we played on our back porch. We live streamed it, not knowing what the hell we were doing. And we had so many people tune in, and we had the Venmo up there, and people were overly generous. It was like, holy cow, we just kind of, you know, it just kind of dumb luck we did it. And you know what, we did it every week for the rest of COVID. So we did like 55 shows
holy
every
shit.
Wednesday. And it, I'm telling you what, Johnny, it kept my wife and I sane. You know, it was something to look forward to.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
got into it. The first night we're getting ready to play, you know, I just set everything up, and all of a sudden, you know, her friend was over, and she's like putting stuff up on the window. I'm like, what are you doing? She said, oh, you're having a stage. I'm like, okay. So she just went to town. And actually, I'm going to tell you something. People tuned in every week because she always had something different going on. And she was the draw. And then our dogs would run back and forth. So I was just kind of background music for the dogs and for her set design. But it kept us alive and afloat and engaged for all that time. And it was a blessing that, you know, it just kind of stumbled into it. And looking back on it, man, it was so much fun. And we got to connect with people that I haven't seen in a million years from right. all over the place. You just
right.
never knew who was going to tune in. And it was an amazing experience. So that really got us through.
Yeah. Dude, man, those, like the first couple of months of it, like the first one I did was at the end of March.
Okay.
And I made so much money.
Oh, it was crazy.
That it kind of like skewed my vision of like, why in the hell have I been putting this shit in my car and driving it? I've just made like three times more sitting and like,
no
just
kid.
Putting fucking pants on.
Right. Oh, I know exactly what you're saying. It's just like, and you know, you turn off your amp and you walk, you know, you're done. You're home.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I hear you, buddy. I hear you. It's a crazy thing, but I think people were so, you know, needing something to kind of hang on to. And it was the fact that we were able to, you know, play and you were able to play, you know, people needed it as much as we needed to do it, you know?
Yeah. And I think that there was like, now in retrospect, I can see it. There was one thing was annoying the shit out of me was that it seemed like people really wanted you to talk to them while you're doing this thing. And at first
yeah.
I didn't get it, but now I really
yeah.
like look, I look back on it and I was like, God, these people were like, they were going to a show and there was other people
yeah.
there. So they're like, oh, Steve, I saw you a couple years ago at the, you know what I mean? And they're like, they're talking to each other. Then you're talking to them and it kind of really like turns into what like a happy hour.
Exactly.
Getting together
exactly.
with everyone. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, man, because I became kind of addicted to a couple of them, you know? There
sure.
were ones that I watched, like, every week, like, clockwork.
Yeah.
And yeah, same kind of thing. All right, so so you got through that, and then you guys made the record after, like, last year or something, or earlier this year or something?
We snuck in, you know how these things just take forever. We snuck into the studio last year, on end of April. And then we had it, you know, had it pretty much in a can, but had to do some tweaks, had to figure out some things, art and all that stuff. And things got pushed back here and there. And we finally had the Austin release, on the 30th of July at the Saxon. And we're going to do a national release in September. So we're just kind of stretching things out a little bit.
When you say a national release, what does that look like in this day and age?
You know, that's a great question. I don't really know. I think it's going to buy me a little bit of time just to get it to some more independent radio stations out there.
Okay.
That might be interested in it. You know what I mean? And I've been delinquent and getting it out. And, you know, Joe Ray very well, and she's a sweetheart. And we were going to shoot for the end of August. And we just kind of had a little conversation last night. She said, well, let's just push it to end of September. I was like, I'm in, you know? So when I figure out what that national release is like, I'll tell you exactly.
Okay. Well, because now it's so weird. It's like everything. Like I saw, and I see this in a lot of stuff, that people are like, hey, pre-order this thing. And I guess if you pre-order it, then there is a chance that it'll chart the day that it comes out. Is that right?
Is that why
people want you to pre-order something?
I believe so. But you know what, Johnny? I don't even understand that process. That's beyond me.
Because there's people that are like, hey, pre-save my record on Spotify. I'm like, dude, what the fuck? It's not even out yet. Like, why did... Everything. Why do I need to start doing this now? But I guess it's because there's so much shit coming at you all the time. You forget, and there's so many records being uploaded.
Oh yeah, and yeah. So I don't understand it, but yeah, I think they want the big line in front of the concert before you purchase it, I guess.
Right. it is interesting, isn't it? So when did you put out your first one? You started doing stuff in 2004. So when you put out your first record, was there already like iTunes and MySpace and shit, or what was going on?
Actually, you know, I had a kind of a garage band in Washington D.C. We made a record back in 1989. Was the band called the Youngsters, and then when we got that record back, vinyl. Once we got that back, everybody had cassette players. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, we don't buy records.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I know what you mean.
So then I get the bright idea. All right, I'm going to put out like a single acoustic thing on cassette. And I'm just behind the times. Get the cassette back. Everybody's got CDs. I'm like, what the hell is going on? So we finally did a CD outright. In 1999, I was living in New York, and we recorded in Lafayette, New Jersey. And we made a record in 99 and called Lover's Vow. And then the next one we did was, I think it was 2007 in Austin. That was Another Day in Texas. And then we did an EP called See You Walkin'. And then we did Till the Wheels Fall Off, I think in 2017, 18. And then this one this right. year.
And the Till the Wheels Fall Off is the one with the 59 Stratocaster.
That is correct. That is, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Is that,
yeah.
Do you feel like that? Because there's a lot of, like, if there's talk about one song in all of your thing, that's like the song people are talking about, right? You feel like that's kind of like... the song so far of yours?
That's correct. It's funny. The first time I played it was with Spencer. We were at the Driscoll, and I had just written it. And he said, you know, he didn't play along. And then after I was done, he said, that's the best song you've ever written. I was like, oh, thanks. But that is definitely the song people gravitate towards. And I wrote it. It's a pretty good story. I'm a huge Buddy Holly fan, and my wife and I do a Christmas card every year. And I knew that there was a statue of Buddy Holly up in Lubbock. So you know, my wife doesn't have the best judgment since she married me. So I talked her into driving up to Lubbock to take our Christmas card picture. So we drove up there, you know, 6 hours, take the picture. And we ended up hanging out in the Buddy Holly Museum, and I saw the guitar sitting there all by itself. And Johnny, it just hit me. It just hit me so hard. It was just like, here's this guitar separated from one of the greatest artists of all time, just, you know, not knowing what happened to him, you know? And I started thinking about it. And then my friend is, they're doing a movie called Clear Lake. And he said, can you write a song for the movie? I said, I think I got an idea, you know? So I wrote 59 Stratocaster. So, it's being considered for that movie, and cross your fingers. I hope it happens. So.
Wow. Yeah. It's a really great song. That's such an interesting perspective, and like one that has it. It's so hard as a songwriter to write something from a point of view. You know what I mean? Like, it's so hard to write something that no one's written before. And that like when you hear that song and you sit down and really listen to it, there's like this like, oh, no one's ever done this before. I mean, that I've heard.
Thank you. And it is hard to get those different perspectives and those kind of little nuances. And I'm glad that you feel that way as a songwriter. You know, it was one of those things that just kind of grabbed me. And it was like that seeing that guitar just had a really profound impression on me. And the result of that is that song, you know, that's what came from it. So, yeah. Well, I'm glad. It's nice to hear you say that, brother. It means a lot.
Thanks, man. I'm a huge Buddy Holly fan, and I don't know. It's never like left me. I've gone through phases where it's very intense, and then other times where it's not. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
But there's something about the genius and his simplicity that kind of like it. There's an urgency that comes through. On the level of the Sex Pistols. That's very, very difficult for somebody in the 50s to really achieve and be like some dork nerd guy that could get on Ed Sullivan as well. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what I mean. We were having this conversation, and the thing I was up for this weekend was, you know, his early birthday party, and there were some great players there. Albert Lee, Peter Frampton, Steve Cropper,
Jerry Callen was there.
Oh, it was nuts. It was nuts. I got to play the after party, which was awesome. But I'm telling you, we had this conversation with several people, several musicians, several people in the music business that somebody was asking me, it's like, how does he have this hold? And well, it's an innocence. It's that urgency you're talking about. And it's that honesty.
Yep.
And it's been, you know, 60 years and it's still profound. Yeah. And they're playing it in this beautiful hall that they built. You know, they're playing his music. And it's so great. It's like you want to hear more of it. And it's been that long a time. It's beyond words, you know, his impact and I think they were saying it was his career was like 500 days or something like that, you know, just something ridiculous.
Incredibly short. And the growth, you know, like people talk about the growth of the Beatles in that 10 year span, but like his growth, like he went from like, That'll Be the Day to True Love Ways, like, in 500 days, like, fuck me, dude.
Oh, yeah, and he's 22 years old. That's not right. That's not fair.
Yeah.
You know? And he's putting strings in there, and it's beautiful, and it's great, and it's just, yeah, just amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because what I was going to say was his he had this ability to have this musical simplicity that also allowed him to have this emotional complexity in his message. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Here as we analyze the work of Buddy Holly.
Well, it was funny. I was talking to a player this weekend, and we're talking about, you know, the chords, you know, a lot of 1-4-5 stuff, but it bounces around, it moves, and it has, you know, it has a vitality to it,
sure.
You know? And that's, you know, I think it was Stevie Van Zandt said something like, you know, Louie Louie, that's a hard song it's hard to write a Louie Louie, you know, it's hard to write something like that, you know, that kind of hits you over the head and it's like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It sounds easy. It sounds simplistic, but there's something behind it that is, like you say, belies kind of the simplicity of it. There's a certain, I don't know, chemistry to it that just really resonates. So I don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. You know what's interesting is that musically there is and in your accent, now that I'm talking to you, I hear it a little bit. But in your music, there is the Detroit is in your music. I have a fascination with Detroit and the music that comes out of there. There's like a rawness. There's just like fucking straight up rock and roll comes out of Detroit. That's what comes out of there.
Kick out the jam, you know?
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. The Stooges, Ted Nugent, even though I hate him. Kid Rock, even though I hate him. Jack White. Bob Seger.
Even Eminem, you know?
Even Eminem, yeah. There's a definite, like, there's something about, like, there's like a hard-working, middle-class, car-building, also, like, fuck you kind of attitude that comes out of there that's so amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, no, I think it's definitely a blue-collar mentality. It's definitely, you know, I've been working all week, and you know what? Now I'm going to have a good time. And you, like you say, fuck you. Here we go.
Yeah, exactly. So you were only there until you were in junior high?
We moved there when I was a sophomore in high school. My mother got another job down in Atlanta. And so we moved when I was a sophomore, going into my junior year of high school. So that was kind of
tough. So you had some time there. What was it like there when you were growing up? Because my experience is being there, while I'm fascinated, the times I've been there to play gigs have been fucking scary.
Okay. Yeah.
like really scary.
Well, there's some, you know, it's definitely a tough town. It's been a tough town, you know, ever since, you know, 67 riots and stuff. There's always been a little something in the air. I never had any bad experiences. I was a kid. You know, my dad all the time, we used to, you know, get on the bus and go downtown and go to baseball games and all that. We used to go to concerts at Cobo Hall, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, dude. That's when Kiss Alive was made.
Yeah, exactly. I saw, it was funny because Peter Frampton was there up in Lubbock this weekend, and I had seen, before the live album came out, I saw that tour and Gary Wright opened up for at Cobo Hall.
So oh, it was really? Awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome, and then I saw, not too long after that, I saw Ted Nugent up there before Cat Scratch Fever came out, when he was just following that great Ted Nugent record, you know, where he let Derek St. Holmes sing, and he just played the guitar, and it's a great record.
Yeah.
But listen to this lineup. It was Ted Nugent, Montrose, and Jay Ferguson.
Who's Jay Ferguson?
Jay Ferguson did Thunder Island. You remember that song?
Yeah.
So, but one thing about Detroit, and this is what I tell people, you know, when I was growing up, there was three or four FM radio stations that hardly ever played commercials. And if you went to a party, one of those stations was on. You know, I mean, sometimes you played records, but you didn't need to, because all those stations were playing just amazing music all the time, and there was a good competition because they were all solid radio stations, you know. So it was really cool. And you know, Jay Giles used to come to town and kill it, and they were from Boston, but they were basically adopted by Detroit, and they had that same mentality. So musically, you know, Bob Seger said, you know, the greatest rock and roll audience are Detroit audience. You know, shit, I've known that for 10 years. There's something to that. You know, there's something to that. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the stations. And it was, you know, there was Motown. There was great music coming out of there. So it was great. I feel really fortunate to have had kind of that upbringing, especially, like I said, with my parents being so musically inclined. I was really, really fortunate to be in that area, I think.
Yeah, totally. So then you said you moved to Atlanta. Were you, when did you start with music? Like, when did you connect with music to the point where you wanted a guitar? Did someone give you one, or what happened?
You know, it's a circuitous story. I always wanted to play. I always played sports in school, and I fooled around with the guitar a little bit, and I'd play, and I'd, you know, play the chords and have fun, and it was invigorating and exciting, and I always loved music. I always wanted to be a rock and roller, you know. And then I would put it away, and then I finally moved from Atlanta to Washington, D.C., and I thought to myself, if I don't get on the stick and really hunker down and learn the guitar. I'm never going to. So I really focused myself on playing, getting guitar lessons, playing, getting in a band. And it was one of those things where I was kind of a late bloomer, but I was a very committed bloomer. You know what I mean?
Right, 'cause right.
I had taken, you can hear our dog. it was one of those things where I just, I have to do this now, and I just put myself into it, and thank goodness, because I would have really, I would have looked back and regretted not having jumped in.
What was your life? You jumped in late, so you went to college and stuff when you were in Atlanta. What were you gonna do? What was your?
Well, it's funny. I studied political science, and I went up to Washington D.C. and I worked on Capitol Hill.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I worked for a congressman. And I was taking, it was funny because I would take guitar lessons from this guy named Paul Bell. It was, this little shop, the guitar shop on, Connecticut Avenue. And in Johnny, you'll appreciate this in Washington, D.C. at the time, you had Danny Gatton, you had, Roy Buchanan, you had, Tom Principato, who else? I think, Nils Lofgren was from that town.
Right.
And, it's killing me. He played, Hot Rod Lincoln. He's in Austin now. Why can't I think of his name? Bill Kirchin.
Oh, yeah.
All those guys and Pete Kennedy and all these guys, all these just killer guitar players were in town, and they would come into this guitar shop, you know? So I was playing, I was taking lessons, running out at lunchtime and taking lessons and finally got in a band. And, you know, and I had a decision to make. I was like, you know, is it going to be politics? Is it going to be music? And I thought, you know, politics is always going to be there. You know, I'm kind of on the younger side of things right now. I'm quitting my job and I'm going to, you know, play music. So that's what happened. So it was kind of one of those midlife crises at 23 years old, but it was one of those things I thought about and consulted people on it. And then it was like, you know what? It's the only thing that makes sense to me. It's what I want to do. You know what I mean? If I didn't do this right now, I'm not going to be happy with myself. So that's kind of what it came down to.
What aspect of politics did you see yourself going? Because the only reason I'm asking is in a fantasy world, in an alternate universe where I chose something else to do with my life.
Right.
I'm like a campaign advisor.
Oh, I like that.
And I think I'd do coke, like cocaine. Like I'd be one of those guys.
Yeah,
but I have this fantasy and I love this strategy. I just love that whole aspect of it. Like I do, it's weird and it's creepy. I'm fascinated by the game of it all.
Oh yeah. And that's a great, and somebody, you know, one of my old buddies used to say, you know, politics is war without bullets. You know what I mean? It's like there's strategy and there's, you got to think of a lot of things and you got to work. There's always something to do.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Roger Stone said politics is show business for ugly people.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that. Yeah.
You Hollywood might have been too good looking to go into it, man.
That's funny. Oh, that's funny. It was public service. You know, that was kind of like my dad. My father's an Episcopal minister. So I grew up kind of, you know, in the church a little bit, and he was very involved politically. You know, he attended the 1963 March on Washington with Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up in that kind of household that was politically active.
Right.
You know, I remember when he said when I was just a little tyke, he took me, we actually lived in Boston at the time because my father was going to school there. And when John Kennedy was shot, I guess he took me to chapel with him. And I remember when Martin Luther King Jr. got shot and Bobby Kennedy and you know, it was just a tumultuous time. And my father was kind of right in the middle of all of that upheaval and what he was doing. So that was kind of the, you know, politics was kind of a way that I thought was a way to help people. You know, that was what I was thinking.
Did you see yourself as like a candidate kind of person or someone that just worked behind the scenes?
I looked at myself as possibly running for office.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about that. I thought about that. What happened to me, you know, is I didn't really have a home base. You know, I moved away from Michigan when I was 16 or 17, and I lived in Atlanta for a little bit, but not for a long time. And then I moved to Washington, D.C. So I just, you know, I would have been kind of considered like a little bit of a gypsy, you know what I mean? So I didn't really have a home base. You know, if I would have stayed in Michigan, that could have happened. If I'd have stayed in Georgia, that could have happened. But I think ultimately, Johnny, I think I would have just gravitated towards the guitar because it was something that was always calling me. You know, it's something I could never get rid of. It was something that was just saying, "Hey, man, what the hell?" You know. But if I was to pursue politics, I think it would have probably been more maybe try to run for office. I don't know.
So you worked a couple more questions, then we can get back to music. I'm just fascinated by it. So you worked in the Capitol?
I worked on Capitol Hill. And I'm going to tell you, it was a time different than now.
Yeah.
There was a time. There was a Christmas time, and I was everybody. It was the last day of everything had closed down, and I was working late. And this is no lie. I walked across because I worked. I lived on the northeast side of the Capitol, so you could walk through the Capitol if it was cold and kind of stay warm on most of your walk. So I walked through the Capitol Rotunda area, the dome. All by myself. I was in that room all by myself right around probably December 23rd, 22nd, and it was surreal. And you couldn't do that now. You know what I mean?
Right, of course.
So that was like kind of a hallowed experience to be there all by myself at night. It was just really cool. So I worked up there for a couple years and, you know, saw the ropes and, you know, it's a tough town. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it like? What years was it, were those that you were there?
I was working on Capitol Hill in for the congressman from 1985 to 1987. So it was a couple of years. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
My dad was on a commission during that time. That was under Reagan. He was the head of the Christopher Columbus Quincentenary Jubilee Commission.
Oh, you're kidding me!
I'm not kidding you.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I got to go up there. I guess I was there when you were there in 86 a few times with him.
Oh my gosh, that's cool.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. In the time that you were there now, and you saw the way that people interacted with each other from across the aisle, right?
Yeah.
And you're seeing how it is now. What comes over you? Obviously it's different. But what comes over you? Is it shock? Is it horror? Is it like, oh, I could see this going this way, or what?
Well, you know, I think things started kind of deteriorating a little bit after I'd gotten out of there. Like, I don't want to get too political, but I'll tell you something real quick. When the house I lived in D.C. was with four other guys, two Democrats, two Republicans. And to this day, we are brothers that, you know, bonded by blood. And we had political discussions. We had good conversations. You know, they were all civil. They were all respectful.
Yeah.
And I just saw two of those guys recently, and we talked about that. And, boy, I don't know if you can do that anymore. I think things are so far apart now that I don't know if that, maybe it does exist, but back then it was kind of a fun, natural thing where, you know, you'd run into people that didn't necessarily, you know, you were kind of working against each other during the day, but
exactly.
You could kind of hang out with at night. I don't know if that's possible now. It seems too acrimonious, but you know, that's my impression. I would be curious to see what that's like now.
It's funny that scenario always reminds me of the Warner Brothers cartoon with Wile E. Coyote and the sheepdog.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Where they go and like, hey buddy, how you doing? Hey Roger, all right man. Then they clock in and try and kill each other for 8 hours, and they clock out like, hey, all right, see you tomorrow, man.
Perfect analogy. Perfect analogy.
Yeah. Well, dude, man, It's such a, what a fascinating thing. And you know, I bet on January 6th, you were glad you didn't follow that job and weren't in that building hanging out, regardless of your politics. Just, I bet you were glad you weren't in there.
Oh, it was so disturbing to me because, you know, people can talk and you heard people talk about it. It's definitely a community up there. You know, that there's people, every person in that complex is connected. You know what I mean? And you're talking about, you know, people that are working in the cafeteria, people that are, you know, custodians and whatnot.
Right. Right.
And it's all a big community. And you know those people, and the police officers. I knew a lot of Capitol Hill police officers. They're my friends. You know what I mean? You walk by them every day.
Exactly.
And Johnny, it was the worst. And we were supposed to play. That was a Wednesday, so we were supposed to do our. We called it the social distancing, concert on the porch. And I said, I can't do it. You know, it's just too. This is just too sad. It's too terrible. To play today and to see that it still bothers me. It still disturbs me every time I see the footage of it. And it's hallowed ground. That's the people's house.
Yeah.
You know, that's what separates us from a lot of other countries is that's all of our place. You know what I mean? So I'll tell you now, it's funny. Here's a little aside. When I was talking about making that decision to either, you know, pursue politics or, you know, music. And the crystallization came to me as I was driving down North Capitol Street. And you can see the Capitol is right to your left and you're up high so you can see the Washington Monument. And so you see the kind of got a good view of the whole city. And all of a sudden, what's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding comes on the radio. And I'm like, you know what? This song says more to me than all this stuff before my eyes right now, and that's what I'm going to do. So that was kind of my road to Damascus moment, you know. So and then to see, you know, to see what happened on January 6th is just heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, all right. So when did you move here?
Well, I moved to New York after DC. I was playing in DC a lot, and I decided I'd gone up to New York to play a little bit at the bitter end, and what was the place next to CBGB? It was the gallery.
Yeah.
313. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I played the gallery a couple times, and I loved going up to New York. I always loved New York, and playing up there was the best. So I decided I needed to do that on a more full time basis. So I lived in New York for about 10 years, playing at the Bottom Line and Rodeo Bar and all those places, and having a great time. And,
wow.
And then I met my wife. Yeah. Then I met my wife who's from Corpus originally, but she lived in Austin. And as we mentioned earlier, she's a flight attendant. So we were in New York and, you know, had a little apartment in the East Village and everything was great. And my band, we had made that record and we got some good reviews out of it. We were doing okay. And then the guys kind of started drifting apart in terms of their commitment. And there was a little break in the action. And coming full circle, it was after the 2000 election, which infuriated me. And my friend who I'd worked for in Congress was going to run for governor of Michigan, my home state. And he remained one of my dear friends. And I told Jen, my wife, I said, you know, I got kind of an inkling to go back and help David run for governor. And she said, well, you know how to get there. I was like, okay. So I'm telling you the short story long here. Sorry.
No, that's, this is awesome.
So there was a little time in the band where, you know, things weren't really gelling. So I was like, I considered going back and I thought, well, if I don't help my buddy out, what am I going to do? You know?
Yeah.
So I went back and this is crazy. So I was going to my car at 8:45 AM on, I believe it was Tuesday, September 11th. Yeah, it was Tuesday because it was election day on September 11th. And I'm walking to my car. And as I was walking to the car, I was like, man, this is a perfect day. This is crystal clear blue skies. It's nice and cool. It's like kind of the first fall coolness. So this is a beautiful day. So I get to First Avenue. I see this car just flying down the road, unmarked police car. I'm like, what the hell's going on? Get in my car, turn on the radio. It's about, somebody's giving this eyewitness account of a plane hitting a building. And I'm thinking it's a World War II reminiscence thing. And then the announcer says, that's an eyewitness account of what just happened down at the World Trade Center. I'm like, what? So I turn the corner on Avenue A and I see the smoke. And I'm like, oh, my God. And my wife's a flight attendant. So I park the car. I see our superintendent on the porch. I say, Henry, you're not going to believe what happened. You know, that the plane just hit the World Trade Center. He said, oh, my God, I got to call my daughter. She works in there. So,
Jesus.
Oh, dude, it was crazy. So I walk in. I wake my wife up. I say, you're not going to believe what happened. You know, a plane just hit the World Trade Center. And so we turn on the TV like everybody else, and then we see the next plane hit like everybody else, and we're like, holy cow. And she said to herself, and she, my wife is the toughest, strongest person I ever met in my, or hope to meet in my life, and she just said, I'm never flying again, you know? So we went to go get blood, and we were too late, you know? It was right after the second plane hit, and we went to 3 or 4 hospitals just down the street, and they were already full up. It was like people were so orderly and so cool. And it's New York City, and everybody was just helping each other out and being cooperative. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. I was going to Detroit to help my buddy out on that very second. You know what I mean? It was just so crazy. And then the decision we made was like, I thought the guy I was going to work for could make things better. You know what I mean? So that was ultimately the decision. So I've ended up going to Michigan. We got our asses kicked. You know, we didn't have any money. We worked hard. We did good, but we were fighting an uphill battle. And it was, that whole year was hell for my wife. It was just hell. You know, we thought I was going to be able to come back to New York. We're going to keep the apartment. Well, her friend didn't want to move into New York after that. And it was just, and she's a flight attendant, and it was just it was a nightmare. And so she didn't know anybody in Michigan. I was working all the time. So at the end of the campaign, we're done. We go through all these cities, and we go through all, you know, pluses and minuses of several cities. Then we get to Austin, and she says, well, that's where I want to go. I'm like, okay, why did we go through that charade? But I owed it to her. So we came to Austin. She knew I would love it. That was 20 years ago. So that's the short story long, buddy. I'm sorry.
These are great stories, man.
So that's how I got to, that's how I got here.
Yeah. So where'd you go? Like, who do you remember the first people you saw or the first places you went when you got here, like to go see music, what you got inspired by?
Well, I'd always been, you know, we visited here a couple times, you know, to see her folks, and came down here to South by Southwest in 2000. And like everybody else, I mean, I fell in love with that before I moved here and realized what a cluster that was for people that lived here. But we come down here and we go to the Continental Club and I was enamored with Austin. And then when we moved down here, I went to go see my buddy Craig Marshall. Was the one of the first shows I went to Jackson Club. Oh, he's so great. Yeah. Such a talent, such a great guy.
Yeah.
So I went, you'll get a kick out of this, and you can ask Richard Vinoy and Irene. The first time I went to the Saxon Pub after basically moving down here from New York, Craig's playing, and somebody says, you're not going to believe this, but there's a Longhorn out in the parking lot. So I walked out in the parking lot. Sure enough, I think it was Cowboy Craig or Cowboy Doug or Doug. I forget. Cowboy Craig, maybe. And he had his Longhorn out there. I thought, you know what, Dorothy? You're not in New York City anymore.
That's right. Exactly right.
But I had seen Alejandro at Marie's Taco after that South by Southwest, and I fell in love with him. And I'd known about him before, and, you know, and so just seeing him down here, it just, you know, it's magical. It was a great time. And I stumbled into the Long Branch Inn way back when J.T. Van Zandt was running the open mics over there, and Calvin Russell was playing, and Brad Robisky. And that's where I met Matt Hubbard and Spencer and, you know, Craig Marshall, and it was a great night. It was just, that's the most fortuitous thing that that ever happened to me was stumbling into the Long Branch Inn on a Monday night. And I wrote a song called The Long Branch Inn, which is basically about going to church, Austin, Texas style. And that's where I got my musical baptism down here for sure.
Oh, that's a great story, man. Have we ever met?
We never have. I've known about you forever, but I don't think we've ever crossed paths. I know we know a lot of the same people, but I don't think we've ever bumped into each other, which is hard to believe.
Here's what I'll say is I kind of knew your name, but when I saw your pictures, I was like, I know that dude.
Well,
so I must have seen you play along the way. Where'd you work?
I bartended at Eddie B's for a long time, so a lot of people know me from there.
No,
you know what I mean?
I never really hung out there or anything.
Okay. Because that sometimes I'll see people on the street and I'll be like, well, how do I know you?
He's, hey, man, Johnny Gowdy's got that steakhouse vibe.
That's right.
So what do you got coming up like in the next couple months?
Well, we're going to be, we've been playing at the Armadillo Den every other month or so. We'll be back there on the 15th.
Of what, August?
Okay. 15th. It's next Monday, actually. Gosh almighty, it's next Monday.
Yeah, this won't come out before then. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine. Hopefully we'll be back in a second, but we play at the Driscoll every Wednesday. We've been doing it for 14 years, every Wednesday from 7 to 9. We play at Guero's the first Friday of every month. We've been doing that for a long time, thanks to Bobby Fuentes, from 6 to 9. And we'll be in Pflugerville at the Texas Spirit of Texas Brewstillery on September the 17th. And we'll be in Smithville October 29th at the Fat Cat, which is supposed to be a pretty cool place. I hadn't been there yet, but I've heard good things. And, yeah. So hopefully we'll get back to the Saxon soon. That's like our home away from home. And, crazy. Yeah.
So those Wero shows are fun, man.
You know, like that was another thing that kept us alive during COVID, because they could open up. I think we started playing there in June or July of 2020.
Oh,
and
really?
So that was a way for the band to keep connected, because they made more than 50% of the sales on food. And they had the outdoor venue, so they were a perfect setup, you know what I mean? And they could social distance, where you could still get a lot of people in there. And like you talked about earlier, during COVID, man, people were so generous with their tips during that time. It was really, really something, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, people can find out where you're playing by going to brucesmithband.com.
Correct, and that's finally been updated and still getting tinkered with, but it's finally getting to be an operational website, which it wasn't for a long time. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, dude, it's been really great talking to you. You're really interesting dude. He's led a really fascinating life.
Well, Johnny, you're too kind, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show. You're an institution, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. And you're an awesome dude, man. Really,
thank you, man.
Your reputation is well deserved, sir.
Thank you, man. Also, the record's fantastic. 1,000 Horses, get out there and check it out. Available now wherever it is you stream and download your jams. And dude, great talking to you.
My pleasure.
Hopefully,
sir.
I'll meet you soon.
Absolutely.
Bye, buddy.
See you, brother. 5 o'clock, fire whistle,
fixing the blow. Wheels whack the gas. That's Bruce Smith Gang. His album, 1,000 Horses, available now wherever it is you stream and download your music. Campbellton is the name of the song that you just heard there. You can find it. Get out there and check him out, man. This guy's really, really great. Find him at brucesmithband.com. And hey, gang, don't forget, when you're out there checking out brucesmithband.com, you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, anywhere. New shows every Tuesday, every Friday, sometimes 3 shows a week. Sometimes they're a little late like today. Sorry about that. There was a little snafu in the machine, but well, yeah, it all works out, doesn't it? Anyway, thank you so much for listening to the show. I want to thank Bruce for doing the show. I want to thank Joe Ray for setting it up. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. Have a great week, whatever it is you're doing. Follow us on Facebook. How did I get here? You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy. Let's get down. First one out of line, jammer in the gear, pop the console, pull the boat, and ice cold beer. A couple miles, 37, coast is clear. Buggy knows the way, so I barely need to steer. I'm ready.
like some old campground. They ain't even got a horse, nary a cow, but my baby rings a bell, keep it coming round. I- I'm rambling, Campbell tonight.